Topic of my talk is what connection there is between an individual's moral status and his or her proper, and that means morally proper, political and legal status. So I'm not a fan of moral status talk, but that's all right. No offense to the conference organizers. But it, you know, I think we can minimize the damage as long as we're very clear about what we mean by it. So I'm going to use moral status in the verdictive sense. So the way I'm going to think about it is that an individual's moral status is just a summary way of referring to all the verdictive facts about that being, i.e. all the facts about what we do and do not owe to that being, what kind of treatment of that being, or of things that being cares about, whatever, to that being. So my thesis is, as you can tell, as you probably guessed from the title of the talk, is that the connection between moral status, and now we know moral status so understood, moral status in the verdictive sense, and proper political and legal status is tenuous or weak. So basically what another way, now that I've explained what I mean by moral status, I guess another way to express my thesis would be the fact that we morally owe or don't owe a variety of things to an individual does not have much by way of implications for what their political or legal status ought to be. It does have, and very little doesn't mean none, but I'm going to, in my short time here, I'm going to focus on what I think will be the more controversial aspect of my view, which is where the connection is absent. I think that the standard view would be that, you know, would recognize quite a few places where the connection is present, and when I agree with that, I'm just not going to say. I'm only going to focus on the areas where I think I disagree with the common wisdom, which is where other people think there is a connection and I think there isn't. So I'm going to talk about political status and then legal status and then run through a few implications and then I'll be done. In political philosophy, I endorse a weak form of political liberalism. I'm not sure it's ever been enunciated before, but here goes. So my version says that the fact that something is good never grounds a reason for the state to pursue it. So I have an argument for this version of political liberalism, and that argument also, in effect, grounds sort of half of my thesis, the thesis about there being a tenuous connection between moral status and proper political status. So I think that when we think about what the state ought to do, we have to focus on what kind of thing the state is. I think it ought to be uncontroversial. I don't know if it is uncontroversial, but I think it ought to be uncontroversial that the state is an institution. Borrowing from a philosopher named Michael Hardiman, I'll define an institution as an ongoing, self-reproducing structure that includes offices and positions, the occupants of which can change over time. So, in order to help us think sort of in an unbiased way about what the institutional nature of the state implies for what the state ought to do, we should set the state aside and think about other institutions and what their institutional nature implies about what they ought to do. So I think uncontroversially, corporations are institutions. So let's just think for a second about what the institutional nature of a corporation implies for what it ought to do. So you've got a corporation. So you set up a corporation, and then you have a question: well, how are we going to use it? How am I going to use it? Now, there are some moral constraints that are simply given. So you're not allowed to, if you are the owner of a corporation, you're not allowed to use it to kill people. Okay, that's just a given. morality sets certain constraints on what you are, on what you may or may not do with your corporation. But a lot, there's quite a, but there are, there's quite a bit of leeway. So so just sort of brute morality doesn't really answer that many questions about what ought to be done with the corporation. What does sort of answer those questions? Well, I think we have to look to how and why the corporation exists in order to get more answers to our questions. So I think like all other institutions, a corporation, the sustaining of a corporation is a joint action made possible by shared intentionality. So what I mean by a joint action is that it's a numerically single action that many people are doing. And when I say it's made possible by shared intentionality, what I mean is the way that action is being accomplished is via the various people doing it having individual intentions that mesh with each other in the right way. So I think what we get when we think about this corporate analogy and we think about how corporations are sustained, we at least may plausibly arrive at the conclusion that the corporation is to be used so as to serve the ends of those who sustain it. So we get something like the shareholder theory of corporate obligation. I know that's controversial. I know not everybody accepts the shareholder theory. But if they don't accept the shareholder theory, chances are the reason why they don't accept it is because they have because their understanding of which set of individuals partakes of that joint intentionality is more expansive. But I think, I hope most all of us can agree that whatever that set of individuals is that sustains the joint intentionality that makes the corporation's sustenance possible, that what the corporation ought to be used for, you know, the people who are employed to work for the corporation, the managers, etc., what they ought to do is serve the ends of those who sustain the corporation. So I think that the same is true of the state. There is a set of individuals who sustain the state through joint intentionality, and therefore the state is to be used to serve their ends. Again, within moral limits. Even if they want to use the state to go around killing people, that's not okay. So now we can return, with that much on the table, we can return to the question of political status and who should have it. Well, political, like as with all the other other levers at the disposal of the state, has all sorts of power, does all sorts of things. One of the things it does is allocate status. As with all other things it does, I think the most general thing that we can say that's true about how political status ought to be allocated is that it ought to be allocated in a way that serves the ends of those who sustain the state. So if and when it's true that some individual ought to be accorded political status, the reason why it's true is because doing so serves the ends of those who partake of the joint intentionality that sustains the state. So it's never the individual's moral status that does the grounding work. It's always something else, something quite different. So really there are two ways then that it can be morally required of the state that it accord political status to some individual. One is that individual, him or herself, partakes of the shared intentionality that sustains the state. Because, operating under the sort of assumption that there, although it's a contingent truth, that it'll be a nearly exceptionless truth, that those who sustain the state will care about them, that they will want political status for themselves. And then the second way is whether that individual is central to the ends of those who partake of the shared intentionality to sustain the state. In other words, whether they're sort of cared about, whether their well-being, their good, is thought of among those who partake of the shared intentionality, is thought of as if they think of it as sort of central to why they are partaking of the shared intentionality, why they're going to the trouble. Now, I admit that what I've said here seems to open the door to institutionalized bigotry, because it seems like basically what I'm sort of implicitly allowing here is that if a group of people sustain a state and they're all bigots and there's some other and there's this other group of people that whose well-being they don't care about at all, as a matter of fact, they help these people do really badly, that their sort of bigotry actually justifies withholding political status from this other group of people, or non-people, whoever these other individuals may be. But ultimately, I think this is a question of excluding individuals from partaking of shared intentionality, and I never said that was okay. I never said it was possible, never mind morally okay, for a group of people who want to partake of shared intentionality with each other to prevent other people from so partaking. So you could sort of, the sort of bigoted project, nothing I've said commits me to saying that the bigoted project is sort of, you're sort of morally permitted to even get that project off the ground if you would like to. Okay, so that's the end of what I have to say about political status. Okay, moving on to legal status. So if we ask the question about whether an individual's moral status entails that they ought to have some kind of legal status, basically we're asking a question about the truth of legal moralism. Now, the kind of legal moralism that we are being forced to talk about here, it's not your father's legal moralism. It's not Hart Devlin legal moralism, for those of you who know the Hart Devlin debate. It's not about whether the fact that some moral proposition is widely accepted or is part of the social morality, whether that fact entails that the law ought to sort of embody it or enforce it. No, this is new school legal moralism. This is whether the fact that some moral proposition is actually true entails that the legal system ought to be sort of structured so as to embody it or enforce it or discharge it or whatever. So when it comes to this kind of legal moralism, I take my cues from a legal philosopher named R.A. Duff. So Duff has a very helpful analogy, I think, for thinking about philosophy of law. What he proposes is that before we can know what content the law ought to have, we need to first think about why we have such a thing as the law. And I think that's absolutely right. And the reason, and the way he demonstrates the usefulness of this way of approaching it by pointing out that if we wanted to know what content some other body of rules had, we would definitely stop to first think about why we have that body of rules at all. And so his analogy is bodies of rules for professional societies. So he often comes back to medicine as his key example. Take an organization like the American Medical Association, the main professional body for physicians in the United States. Let's say they had a clean slate. You know, imagine a time when there just was no, when they had no code of conduct for doctors yet, and they were trying to come up with one. How would they have sort of started to think about what content their code ought to have? Well, Duff proposes, and I think this is right, that the first thing they would have had to think about is, you know, why practice medicine? What's medicine for? What are we doing that for? And then once we have an idea of what we're doing medicine for, then we can think about what a good set of rules governing the conduct of medicine would look like. So under the supposition that that is an art, that that sort of that that sounds intuitively right, Duff wants to say, well, we should say the same thing about legal systems. Why do we have, why have legal systems as opposed to not having them? Well, what Duff says is that just as the AMA's code of professional conduct is to govern the conduct of physicians as physicians, the law is a code of conduct to govern the behavior of citizens living together as citizens living together. So we have to think about why, analogously, in the case of the AMA, the first thing we had to think about is like, why do medicine? The first thing we got to think about here is sort of why live together? Why live together in some sort of organized way with political structures instead of living in anarchy? So we don't need to give an answer to that question. We can actually get pretty far in thinking about what the law ought to say, just knowing that that question needs to be asked, never mind actually answering it. We can just put in a placeholder for whatever the answer is, to why live together under political structures instead of having anarchy. Whatever the answer is, the placeholder word for it, at least Duff's placeholder word for it, is the res publica. That is the sort of the body of ends that we together are trying to achieve through political means instead of leaving it to anarchy to solve it. So what the law is for, then, is to promote and make more likely the achieving of the res publica. And this essentially makes legal philosophy a branch of political philosophy. And I think that's entirely right and proper that it should be conceived of that way. We need to do a little political philosophy first. We need to determine what the res publica is. And then we can find out what sort of laws we ought to have. So if it's right that legal philosophy is a branch of political philosophy, then I kind of already answered the question about legal status by answering the question about political status. My weak political liberalism, my claim that it's never the fact that something is good that grounds the fact that the state ought to produce it, and ergo, even more so, it's never the fact that an individual has moral status that grounds any fact about what status the state should accord to that individual. So that weak political liberalism entails legal liberalism. So the way I'm going to define it is that the fact that some action would be bad for someone or wrong someone never grounds a reason for us to use the law to address it. What does ground reasons for us to use laws to address things is that the doing of that thing undermines the res publica. So we get two conclusions from this. It's never an individual's moral status that grounds her proper legal status. And legal moralism is false. So I'm something more like a legal liberal. I think I'm a legal liberal in a quite strong sense, even stronger than Joel Feinberg was, who is considered sort of the standard bearer of legal liberalism. Interestingly, Duff himself ends up endorsing legal moralism, but I think that he just didn't properly follow through the implications of his own argument. But that's by the by. All right, so that's it for my sort of defense of the idea that moral status has very little to do with proper legal status. What are the policy implications? Well, I think at least a few of the policy implications of what I've said will be quite intuitive. Like they will accord with people's pre-theoretical intuitions. But I don't have that much time, and so I want to focus on the controversial things. So I'm just gonna tell you the controversial implications, not the uncontroversial ones. And only a couple of the controversial implications, just because of limits to my time. So I think the most interesting implications of what I've said so far are in terms of what we are morally permitted to do, because there are implications in terms of what we're morally required to do, but I want to focus on the implications in terms of what we're morally permitted to do. So if we want to extract some implications from what I've said, we have to ask at least this one question, well, at least these two questions, excuse me. Which individuals partake of the joint intentionality that sustains the state? call that set of individuals X. And which individuals are such that their good is central to X's ends. The reason we have to ask that question is because those are the individuals such that we're going to have a good argument for our being morally obligated to accord them some political and legal status. I'm going to focus on AIs, artificially intelligent machines, just because I think it's interesting. So I submit to you that AIs, at least the ones that sort of get talked about, the ones that are most likely to exist, the first ones that are most likely to exist, will be AIs that cannot partake of joint intentionality. The reason why is because I think partaking of joint intentionality requires seeing other individuals as rational agents. Remember, joint intentionality involves each individual that partakes of that joint intentionality having one or more intentions that meshes in the right way with the intentions of others. And I think that if you look at what people who are experts in this area of sort of social metaphysics will tell you, people like Bratman, who have even quite weak requirements for shared intentionality, will tell you that the intentions have to have some sort of second personal reference. They have to be intentions to do something with others. And I think AIs can't do that. And the reason I think AIs can't do that, AIs can't have thoughts like that. The reason I think that goes back to a distinction I think we owe to P.F. Strawson's Freedom and Resentment. I could be wrong there. The distinction between two different ways of viewing others, viewing other objects. We can view other objects, and by objects I include living things, and even intelligent living things. We can view other objects as things to be managed or as things to be reasoned with. And these are two sort of very basic there's a sort of basic fundamental distinction between these two ways of approaching other individuals. So hurricanes, I think all of us view them as things to be managed. It wouldn't make sense to view them as things to be reasoned with. They just are what they are. We can try to predict what they're going to do and then react accordingly in whatever way best promotes our ends. Other, you know, human persons of average intelligence and maturity, at least we can, and often we do, interact with them as individuals to be reasoned with. We don't just take what they're going to do as a given and then try to protect our interests the best we can. We think we can engage with them and propose reasons why they ought to change their intentions and things like that. So my understanding of AIs is that they only do the former. They interact with all of us in that former way and exclusively in that former way. For that reason, they cannot partake of shared intentionality. So they are not among the individuals who partake of the shared intentionality that sustains the state. I also would propose, and this is an empirical claim, that they are not central to the ends of those who do partake of the shared intentionality that sustains the state. So one implication then, I think, and this is making a big leap, there are a bunch of intermediate premises that I'm leaving out just for the sake of time, I think it's permissible to withhold citizenship from them and all the things that go along with citizenship, like the right to vote. I also think it's permissible to make no law criminalizing the destruction of AIs. And again, I'm leaving out a whole bunch of intermediate premises, but I do think that by a series of sensible premises, we can get from what I just said about joint intentionality to that conclusion. So that's just a taste of some of the implications we get out of what I've said. I have to stop there for time consideration. I look forward to your questions, and thank you for listening.